You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We pretty much understand library collections hold the depth and breadth of our experiences. Our past informs our present and then directs us toward our future. But have you ever stopped to think about just how these important pieces of our past are gathered and preserved? Well, it happens thanks to the hard work of people like Lewis Jones. Dr. Jones is the field archivist for the Walter Reuther Library at Wayne State University in Detroit. He documents the American labor movement, the civil rights struggle, and the history of metropolitan Detroit. And he's being recognized and honored as a fellow of the Society of American Archivists. It's one of the profession's highest honors. Lewis Jones, welcome.
Yeah, thank you, Cynthia. It was great to be here.
So to anybody who wonders what you can do with a degree in history, here you are, Exhibit A, years of study capped off by your PhD in American history from Wayne State. And now you're getting this very, very high honor for your work as a field archivist. So congratulations.
Yeah, thank you very much.
What is a field archivist?
Oh, boy, good question. Let me just back up just a little bit and explain what an archivist is. We collect, we preserve, and we provide access to documentary heritage. And so we do that for organizations, for people, for state, local, and federal government. And archivists are located in hospitals, in universities, in corporations, religious institutions. And so when I say collect, preserve, and provide access to documentary heritage, I'm talking about people and organizations, largely. And like I said before, local, state, and federal governments. We're talking about press releases, correspondences, you know, a whole range of audiovisual material, might be lecture notes, whole range of what we call primary sources. And this is the basis of a lot of the history that you'll see written. You'll see documentaries that make use of archives. You'll see exhibits in museums that make use of archives. Journalists occasionally make use of archives as well. And as a field archivist, though, it's my job to convince people to give us their stuff. So in my particular job at Wayne State University at the Walter P. Reuther Library, I collect the records of people and organizations connected with the historical development of metropolitan Detroit. And I'll do a little bit of that with Wayne State University, although we have a university archivist that does most of that. And records and papers of organizations and of people connected with organized labor. And that's actually what we're known for more than anything else. But we have a pretty large collecting scope that covers metropolitan Detroit.
And what brought you to be focusing on the labor movement and the kind of work that you're doing for the Reuther?
Right. That's been the collection scope of the archives at Wayne State, really not since its inception. The founding director of the archives, a guy by the name of Phil Mason, came on board in 1958, and he was the university archivist at that time and collected a lot of material around the university, nurturing relationships with administrators and secretaries and other folks that had records in their possession on campus, and brought many of those records back that weren't being used for the current purposes, brought them back to the archives. And it was in pretty Kresge Library at the time. But even as he was walking in the door, he had it in his mind that he wanted to develop a labor archives. And so he started nurturing relationships with the International Executive Board of the UAW and with Walter Reuther himself, and convinced the UAW that Wayne State University should be the home for their official historical records. And that took place in 1962. Subsequent to then, he began nurturing relationships with other folks in the organized labor, including Cesar Chavez. And we have the records of the United Farm Workers. That's Cesar Chavez was the longtime president of the organization. So many others. The Industrial Workers of the World, which is a very radical organization of the early 20th century, still exists, but not what it was in the early 20th century. The government chased it out of existence to a large extent.
Well, what I'd like to do is, I was going over, you have a mind-boggling 9-page CV, including this stunning list of collections that you've helped to bring into the Reuther. As I look through, you know, we're talking names like Damon Keith and Wade McCree and Tony Spina, the Detroit Free Press photojournalist, the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, Sonny Elliott, any Detroiter who grew up watching him on TV, the beloved weatherman, the Detroit branch of the NAACP, so many. So out of this rather stellar list, I'm wondering, what are some of your personal highlights, you know, people that you've sat down with and stories and artifacts that you just could not believe you were part of?
One of them is a name that you didn't mention and that you probably won't hear much about on other occasions, but I got a very interesting phone call two or three years ago from a woman who had a collection of material that her grandfather had kept. Her grandfather was a guy by the name of William Gurney here in Detroit. And he was hired by a corporation. I forgot exactly which one now. This would have been in the 30s and the 40s. He was hired by a corporation to infiltrate the Communist Party here in Detroit. And we've heard plenty of stories about how folks have infiltrated the Communist Party and organized labor for that matter, too, but not the records that kind of go into some detail about what they did and how they went about doing
it. Yeah, the nuts and bolts.
The nuts and bolts of it. And he had a biography that he wrote, about 40 pages, about 7 pages of which are missing for reasons we're not sure clear about. But in this biography and other records within his collection, he documents how he infiltrated the Communist Party in Detroit and actively sought to wreak havoc within the organization.
And also monitored activists working for Ford Motor Company in the 1940s.
Exactly. Wow. As a matter of fact, he worked for Harry Bennett.
Yes. So,
a name that some of your listeners may be aware of.
Certainly.
But he was in charge of the security, to put it mildly, for Ford Motor Company. And had, you know, literally like a goon squad, folks that ex-cons and other folks that would beat up and harass UAW and other folks that were perceived to be activists who worked at Ford Motor Company.
Somebody who is not necessarily known, not like a name like Leonard Woodcock or Wade McCree or that, but somebody who had an integral part of labor history in Detroit.
Absolutely, absolutely.
You know, I as you build this collection, I'm wondering, as you're acquiring things, you're talking with people, you're talking them into giving up their documents,
right.
Their photos. Are you thinking at that time of the historians of the future?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the joys of the field for me, and I think I speak for a number of my colleagues too, is not only getting the material, which is important in of itself, but having people walk into our reading room and order request boxes from our stack area and actually make use of the material. And you find this material wind up in books, in articles, in exhibits that are in museums and in documentaries as well. And that's really, you know, the joy I get out of the field, not just collecting it, as important as that is, but seeing it used not just by historians, but all kinds of people make use of the material. Genealogists, I think I mentioned journalists before, a whole range of other kind of people, people working on their dissertations and master's thesis and students that are working on their bachelor's degrees. Their professors often have them come into the archives and want to give them a sense of what's involved in working with what we call primary sources.
I'm speaking with Dr. Lewis Jones, who's the field archivist for the Labor and Urban Affairs Archives at Walter P. Reuther Library at Wayne State, who will soon be honored as a fellow of the American Society of American Archivists, which is the highest honor the SAA can bestow. What kinds of changes have you seen, Lewis, through the years? You've been archivist since 1993, so you've crossed into the digital age.
Yes, and actually that's really the basis of some of the changes, too. When I first came to Wayne State University, there would be consecutive days where there would be literally nobody in our reading room. The lights would be off. It'd be dark in the reading room. And we still get a good deal of reference work that we'd have to provide folks over the phone. But there was no internet then. That was crazy talk. But over the years, obviously, that's changed incredibly. Whereas it used to be a time where people knew about us because they read a book and they saw a footnote in a book that made reference to some material that they were interested in, and they gave us a call to find out what other kind of material that we may have that might support their research interests. It wasn't until the internet exploded that began to change. So our guides to our collections now are all online. And whether people live across the street or, you know, on the other side of the planet, they can find out what's in our collections, what's in each one of our collections. And so when they walk in the door now, and they walk in far larger numbers now than they did when I first came on board. Matter of fact, there's rarely a shift. We have 2-hour shifts on the reading room desk. There's rarely a shift where there's not a researcher in the reading room, and oftentimes many researchers. And so
that must warm your heart.
It does. I mean, it keeps us busy, but, you know, that's what you get paid for. And it also means that a whole range of literature, of documentaries, of exhibits, a whole range of projects are able to be pursued because people are walking the door because of the internet and the digital age that they just made reference to.
What are the keys to being a good archivist to preserve our own history? How can we best do what you're doing in our own lives with our own families?
Oh, boy, that's a very good question. We'll hold on to material for one. Many times people just throw material away. But material, for a whole range of reasons, can be very important. You yourself may not be interested in the material, but I'm willing to bet within every family there's somebody, the mother, the father, the kids, the nephew, somebody that's going to be interested in that material. So I encourage people to hang on to it. And this material can be photographs, yearbooks, letters that you've written or that you've received. It's just a really great idea to hold on to it and to pass it down, if not to an archive like the one where I work, then to another family member that may have use for it because their child or they themselves will be interested in it and trying to explain who they are, who their family is, where they came from, what their identities are all about. And a lot of that is all wrapped up into these records that people have, but they oftentimes throw them away.
In fact, I will tell you, of amongst my circle of friends, people who are, baby boomers who are nearing a certain age, the big question is, do we hang on to the love letters and let the kids find them when we're gone?
You're right. Good question. Yeah, it could be a dangerous thing too, right, to hang on to records like that. But if they're stored away privately in the appropriate kind of way, I think even those could be valuable. Although we all understand if there might be some reasons why you would not want to do that.
What is at stake in the work you do, Lewis?
Well, if there are not people like me, if there are not institutions like where I work, then the things that we know won't be known. It's really kind of as simple as that. The books that we read, they're not all based on research that are done at our archives, but many of them are. The documentaries that we look at, I mean, there are very few documentaries that you look at because documentaries are almost inherently historical in some manner, shape, or form. But the overwhelming majority of them are in part, at least, based on research done at places where I work. It's the memory of institutions, of cities, of countries, of the human experience. It's our memory, and without them, we would not know what we know. I often think about the things that I remember, and they're often, well, not often, but occasionally, they're in conflict with things that have been written. And so sometimes I'll reflect on something and I'll be clear in my mind that it happened in a certain time and in a certain place. And I'll look back at a letter that I wrote and said, nope, that's not exactly the case. But that record won't change. It doesn't necessarily tell the truth because all records are biased in some manner, shape, or form. But a record is a record and they don't change. In the digital era, we have to be particularly concerned about these things because they can change a digital record. But we're talking about hard copy records. They are what they are. They might be interpreted differently today than they were 50 years ago or 50 years from now, but they do not change. And so the memories of our families, of our institutions, of our cities, and all of that is wrapped up in these records in large respect.
Dr. Lewis Jones, field archivist for the Walter P. Reuther Library at Wayne State University, and congratulations on your upcoming honor from the Society of American Archivists.
Thank you.